Okay, welcome everybody. This looks like a smaller group than I expected. We had originally intended to break out into smaller groups again. What's your feeling? Would you rather talk to five people first and then share, or would you rather do this as a group?
Depends on the topic.
The topic is exactly what we've been talking about the entire day, reducing barriers. Our job is going to be what Brad pretty much set up, which is tell them what to do. Seriously, I mean, I think besides groups is fine. I think so as well.
It's worked well with the size before.
Can I ask you to participate?
Yes.
You're prompt as I should.
You can ask.
Okay. Okay. And you can get a little rowdy. I think that's okay too.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for coming. I know how valuable your time is. We all recognize that. It's been said many times. It's a big chunk of a day, and I know that you folks don't have a chunk of a day to give away, so thank you. I have become convinced, talking to all the SBA people, all the White House people, that we are going to have an impact from this. There are people that I had to hand invite and call up to follow up with, but so I've made it my mission that we will have an impact, that what we say today will end up on the president's desk. So, I mean, it's worth the effort that we're taking here today. So essentially, our job is to identify barriers. And at the same time, I'd like to, literally at the same time, almost like a T account, barriers and solutions. And even if you know the barrier and can articulate it and don't have the solution, I think we're a brain trust here. And I think we can come up with at least some ideas for solutions. So there's an operative question which is out on the table, which is, what is the biggest barrier that you have seen for your business, and what would you suggest the government do about it? Yes?
I'd like to suggest, I actually used to work for the Women's Chamber of Commerce 18 years ago. SBA had 60 people working in Colorado. Now they have 14 and they're down to 6. I think one of the biggest barriers has been, over time, government's lack of support. It seems to be very cyclical. And over the last 20 years, it's been gone down so much. And so has the emphasis on making things easier for small business. So I think, number one, if government has, there's got to be a longer term promise that whatever gets put out there will actually stay there for a certain period of time instead of going up and down as administration structure.
Anyone else follow up on that one? Okay, so there's a lack of SBA resources and a lack of continuity, and the solution then would be?
Over the last 20 years, it has been, yes.
Okay, and it's been up and down, and the solution then would be?
That a much longer term, that there is a commitment by federal government to actually say this is important, and over at least a 10-year time frame, we will continue to put resources and efforts over.
Okay.
I would say one of the biggest barriers that we have is the lack of DC or some of our federal partners to support and promote the existing technical assistance providers that are out there that are already doing it. There is a lack of communication. They don't take credit for their programs that are already in existence. Everybody wants to recreate the wheel instead of supporting our existing programs that are out there that have a proven track record. So I would say it's the communication side of it that is missing from the White House, from D.C., from our federal partners on the resources that are already in place that are successful.
Okay, Kelly's a ringer. She's my boss. My name is Sharon King. I'm with the Small Business Development Center. And the SBDC network is actually an organization through the SBA. So thank you for the plug.
Can you give us a couple of examples?
Sure. You know, it's just like any organization. Everybody wants to think that there's something new that they can create.
No, I understand, but I mean specific organizations or programs that you see are very successful for emerging businesses.
The SBDC program. Mm-hmm. We provide free counseling, low-cost or no-cost training. We did almost $85 million in capital formation, almost 4,200 jobs created and retained last year. Yet we do not get the communication to refer to us over and over again. So it's a big problem. You know, we have lots of partners around the state, but this is not a state issue. This is a national issue. If you go to any state, you're going to see the same exact thing, that SBDC is not promoted nearly as much as some of the other partners.
Okay, thank you.
I agree with that. As a local entrepreneur, you know, does the SBDC do any outreach to small businesses? Do you specifically go out and target the ones that you feel could use the help?
Absolutely, but you have to understand we have the barrier of financial burden. There's only so much money that we can do. Do you have the supply to meet the demand to meet the supply? So if we have partners that help market for us, that's less time that we have to physically be on the road doing the outreach, and we'd be there to provide the consulting and the training.
How much of your funding do you get from the federal government, and is it principally from the SBA?
SBA and then the state, and that's state. Pretty well, that's not necessarily true nationally. About 50% of our funding is fed.
Okay.
And it's a matching SBA grant program, so that there's also local money that gets right put to it.
It's a one-to-one match.
Okay.
Now, the job school funds that went out is a non-match. Great. You know, great moving in that direction.
Okay, you're going to have to forgive me when I stop people, mm-hmm, and we keep moving on.
Okay.
Yes. Sorry, I'll get to it.
Technological illiteracy and the generation gap between millennials and baby boomers, especially in rural areas.
Keep going.
Yeah, it's all the right problem the federal
like
government can.
I would like to see a program, perhaps, or some type of, you know, this initiative address areas where particularly baby boomers aren't able to use computers. I see that all the time.
Okay, tell us how that's going to help entrepreneurs.
You're
the entrepreneur today. How is that going to help you today?
To enable higher skilled employees.
Okay. How does the solution look? Is it money put toward education?
Absolutely.
Okay. So we've got a theme going on here about education.
Okay, I was doing a new bullet point.
That's okay. No, we're good. Part of this is to figure out how things group, because they may all come down to something more simple. Yes?
Well, I was just going to make a point specific to that, for example, something as simple as paying your federal payroll tax, you are now required to pay electronically. You're no longer allowed to take it from bank. So that does impact a lot of the older generation entrepreneurs.
Okay. And so would you suggest that they go back to allowing
paper? Well, I think that wasn't very well thought through in order to, I mean, you get a notification and, okay, in 2 months, that's it. You can't do it this way anymore. Without any type of learning curve or input apparently back. It was just a mandate that was set out.
And how people understand, absolutely. So one is sufficient lead time, especially for smaller businesses who don't have the same kind of resources and technical sophistication perhaps in large entities. So a longer lead time for small businesses and more counsel, technical assistance or?
Yeah, when there is a technical issue like that.
Absolutely.
To allow for the older generational to,
sure,
to determine how am I going to do this? Do I have to go to the library and how to pay my payroll?
So that's great. And if that is exactly actually the kind of provision or flexibility that we can help build into regulations before they go forward, and that we work very hard with the SBA Office of Advocacy to try to make sure is in them. So just so you know, there's an act called the Regulatory Flexibility Act, which requires agencies for rules that are going to have a significant impact on a substantial number of small entities to do that and to basically certify that they're putting that kind of flexibility in. So that's where our office can come in, and that's a great idea. Okay.
In fact, the IRS as well as one of the agencies?
Yes. It's, to the extent anyone can affect the IRS, yes. Absolutely. We try. They have some fun with the IRS, yeah.
Okay, well, we can't let you go with that. Is there anything specific about the IRS you want to?
I had a specific example. At the end of 2009, we were to make a deposit electronically. So the person responsible to do that was out sick. Another person took a check to the bank, sent it, got to the IRS. The IRS filed a lien because it was not deposited in the right envelope. I could use that analogy. Mm-hmm. $25,000 later, with county people talking to various IRS offices around the country, it's still waiting for a review in Denver. That is not productive.
No, it's not. First of all, I'm incredibly empathetic. I'm not quite sure what to put down because I'm not sure whether it's a regulatory issue or whether it's a systems issue at the IRS.
Systems issue.
And I think that IRS reform, obviously making our systems run better, is an overarching issue. Should we put that down? I only want to put things down that we maybe have a solution that's more concrete, but I'm happy to write it down.
Incidentally, the incumbent filed it wrong with me.
Yeah, we don't have our horror
here.
Stories.
Literally.
What do we think?
If I understand correctly, some of the smallest things
yes.
may turn out to be something that's actionable.
Hugely burdensome.
So I'm not sure how to craft it so that it's a
acknowledging that it's an absolute. I mean, it's probably examples of every single agency that we need to improve on. Do you have a thought?
You know, it'd fall under something like procedural flexibility too.
Right.
Because I had the same case. I had a case that I had the same situation with the IRS, where it wasn't a new regulation; it was an existing one that they didn't enforce. And up and out of the blue, they decided enforcement to the tune of $85,000. Where it wasn't, and it was also a situation where they didn't allow a person
yes.
to immediately rectify.
Yes.
Enforcement.
It's enforcement flexibility.
But it's procedural.
Yes,
so it's like
absolutely.
You said, it's like there's a procedure involved in this that needs to be, there needs to be not a mandate from down top to say, guys, look, you know, you can't just suddenly out of the blue say, here's $85,000 fine without giving them the opportunity to.
It's a culture change as well in the agency. I will just say one thing. I think the Jobs and Competitiveness Council, the President's Jobs and Competitiveness Council, I think is going to make enforcement flexibility an issue that they're going to look into. So that's good news because that's an important issue. That's the actual interface between you and the government, really.
Is there an advocacy path that could be created for things that are very small?
Right.
But I wouldn't know where to take that.
Right, there you go. Like an ombudsperson or an advocate.
Or some kind of an advocacy process.
That's him.
Another. The ombudsman's office. You can go online to the SBA ombudsman and file a form right there.
Okay, this is cross-agency.
The ombudsman will go to the IRS with that issue and is required to respond to it.
They respond, and they tell you we'll get back to you. This is a year and a half through the advocacy office. Mm. My accountants are still dealing with the IRS trying to get a hearing scheduled. And by the way, they received all the money before the time required, just in the wrong envelope. They didn't like the color of the envelope.
Let me take a question from up here. You had one? Or
it's off the subject of the IRS. My question, I got two. One is, what is the purpose of Group 1? Did you specify any particular participation in Group 1? Are we all small business owners? Are we government contractors? Or are you just trying to divvy it up?
It's a mix.
This is a mix.
Okay. So any issues welcome.
So how many years as a government contractor that actually contracts with the federal government? Okay. There's something out there called the Federal Strategic Sourcing Initiative. We call it FISC. And it's the death of small business. Basically, what the federal government has started to do, coming down from GSA and OMB, is they are now taking schedules. For example, they just recently did Schedule 75 for office supplies, and they awarded a $100 million contract to 15 companies. If you don't have the Federal Strategic Sourcing Initiative contract, you lose your business base. Veterans Administration, GSA, EPA, Department of the Interior, and some of those that I can't think off of that, have now mandated the use of the FISC contract, irrespective of price or small business designation, which means that they can still go to Staples and Office Depot and be compliant under this FISC contract. The challenge that I have with this is being a federal government contractor for the past 15 years, and I've played the game, done everything that I was supposed to do with the federal government to get these contracts. And now that they've implemented this second generation FISI, it's literally shut the doors on hundreds of small businesses throughout the country, and it's getting ready to shutter a whole lot more. Because those companies' client base are now being mandated to go to only 15 vendors. So I'm curious to know, since this initiative is so huge, and there's not one person or agency behind it, how do you think that you can support the small businesses that are doing federal contracting work to not get bamboozled by the whole contracting mechanism? When we invest hundreds of thousands of dollars into procedures and resources and compliance tools, and you're talking about the CFR, and you're talking about the FAR, we're talking about every element that it takes to contract with the federal government, and then you get thrown under the bus because you don't win a reverse auction, which, by the way, I don't think anybody in here would want to go below cost on that. So how would the SBA be able to support us small businesses when GSA and OMB are driving this FISI initiative, and they're going to extend it across all government contracts? If you don't know this or not, Schedule 7 is next. Schedule 36 is also next. They're basically going to constrict the entire GSA schedule. Their intention is by about 50%, so I need help.
So the question you're asking points to what the problem is?
The FISI is the problem. The fact that we have no support, we've written our congressmen, our senators, I've met with the House Small Business. We're not taking this lightly. There's a big movement out there trying to stop it, but nobody seems to be able to have the power or the will to be able to do this because it's a political op-ed.
Right. So just to get the problem down, FAR regulations scare me, so I try to stay away from them. But we have an Office of Federal Procurement Policy in OMB, as you know, and they're, I'm sure, very involved in this. FSSSI,
Federal Strategic Sourcing Initiative.
Yep.
So right now we currently
And the issue is that the FISI process is being constrained so that small businesses can't
qualify. It's eliminating small business competition in the GSA schedule.
So it's FISI reform, I'm sure that they would call it, is actually leading to exclusion of small entities.
Exactly.
Okay.
There's a number of small businesses that I know that have shut their doors because of this.
Well, and that seems to contradict what I've been told about new efforts for small business.
This is crushing. I can give you so much data on this.
But
we need help.
It's really well articulated. We really appreciate it.
Can I just say one thing
sure.
on that? Because this is a bit of a complicated issue, and it's obviously an incredibly important issue. If you would take the opportunity to actually send some materials on this issue into the website that's been set up around Startup America, the whole point there is we're able to accept more detailed, granular information, and then we can work it.
And that website is in this handout, right?
I'm going to give it to you by the end of this conversation.
Yeah, don't worry. You will have that when you leave.
Sir, corresponding to what you were saying,
yes.
There's two areas. We're looking at the FAR, the DFAR, which you said you don't want
to
touch.
No, I sometimes have to.
Whether you're going after the contracts or the government side or subcontracts on the private side,
yep.
She mentioned it's the kiss of death. And because it's a small business program, which is really not enforced, and it's not just my take, it's out in the community for small businesses, where you turn around and you have individuals that use it to their advantage or use decisions based off the FAR not to award a small business. She mentioned the GSA, and the GSA is just a justification without using any regulation whatsoever
right.
for awards. So when we're looking at Schedule 70, we're service disabled veteran owned small business. Similar to what she went through, they had a big compete. You get on the GSA schedule, you're out competing. They turn around and have these programs for service disabled. Out of 8,800 registered members for Schedule 70, they turn around and award the service disabled veterans only 100 out of 8,000. This contract. Here in Colorado, there's only one approved GSA, for the service disabled, I don't know what it's called, I'm sorry, Stage Fright. They turn around and they award to just one company. here in Colorado. So if you try to get any VA work, you're eliminated because you're not on that schedule, even though you hold a GSA schedule. So when we have individuals that are advocating the same thing, I'm glad to hear it, because the FAR is not friendly towards small business or socioeconomic firms. 72% of all business is small business. Of that, 24% or thereabouts is minority-owned businesses. We're not seeing the language which should be required, where they say goals. They're just goals. There's so many failing failing agencies that are not meeting requirements or the goals. OPM is one of them. Up until 2 years ago, they just implemented in their office a small business program, which how many years have they been in business, and they're the clearinghouse for, you know, all of government HR. And so these are areas where you try to fight uphill battles and you get an audience like this. I appreciate this and being able to share with you some of the stuff that she states that we face as small businesses, not just from the government, but also for the private industry.
So is the solution you just need fairness? I mean, is it a common sense application of fair trade?
Leveling the playing field somewhere along the lines where instead of having goals, stronger language requires government plus private companies.
So you know what the playing field really is.
Yeah,
I'd like to agree, and I hope you guys would say something too, is that I've just been starting to deal with some of this as well on the government contracting side. And I would probably articulate that there needs to be more support, a bit more, for the small business side. When there is, it says goals, it's not always met, or it's not always publicized.
Right.
Can I
ask a very quick question, and if we keep the answer short too, because I know we have a lot of other thoughts. First of all, it's obvious that small businesses feel that a lot of the current contracting system or some of the reforms are to your detriment. My guess is that a lot of them are motivated in an era of constrained government resources by a belief, maybe a wrong belief, that by doing it this way, government is going to save money somehow, be more efficient. Do you all feel that that is or is not the case, and that you all can actually come in just as competitive? And frankly, even if it was a little more, maybe that's a societal, you know, equity. We'd be willing to pay a little more to support a small business. But you all don't think that it's a big cost difference to government?
No, I've got spreadsheets and data galore that I can forward.
Yeah,
to
yeah.
I can honestly tell you for this. We lost out a big contract because of the individuals that used
I understand, and I understand, I believe it happens. Yes. Okay, thank you.
I'd just say...
Contracting?
No, nothing to do with contracting. Maybe it will
resolve into
it. Maybe it'll evolve into it, yeah.
I have one more quick contracting thing. So I think more strict regulations and transparency. You talked about the transparency piece. Why not have these awards? It took me almost 2 months to get an RFP of a winning contract here in town to have someone print it up and do that. Why can't we just put that online? It's just so easy, and it would level the playing field and make it more fair for everyone.
Sharon, to add on to that, there's a 3% mandate for federal contracts for services and vets. There's preferences set up for small, which are minority, 8A, HUBZone, all that kind of stuff that goes along with it. The problem it runs into is that there's no fiscal penalty for these large companies to not even meet that 3% mandate for services-abled vet-owned business.
Oh, so, I've heard that. Yes, so there's
so that's a big thing. You know,
there's no downside for them to not comply with the law.
All they have to say is, we tried, and they can use that as an excuse. So that's a big thing. There should be watchdogs on people to look at what are the penalty for these large contracts not to meet at least that minimum 3% and efforts on the small side.
And I just want to add that it's not just disabled vets. It really is across the board. All of the different set-asides have the same experience. So anything else on contracting before we move on?
Two real quick things. One is just to piggyback on that issue of the schedule. Another big stumbling block is contract bundling, where, okay, we're going to put it under this GC or this group of GCs, and we have painting and drywall and carpet and all these other various things, and so we're going to save money because of that. Well, they're not taking into account, apparently, you've got the GC's overhead and profit, and then you've got everyone else's overhead and profit, and it trickles down and trickles down. The government pays a lot more money. And especially if there's no requirement that they actually do strategic subcontracting which is then going to bring in the set-asides to ensure competitive bidding. So that's one thing, just to show that it's not just in the schedules, it's in the contract bundling as well. Now, specific to contracting, there are certain FAR regulations that are extremely harmful to small business. One in particular is something called the Miller Act waiver. Miller Act is a bonding mechanism to protect both performance for the government to assure a job is completed, as well as to protect subcontractors and material suppliers for their payment, to assure they get paid for their work. In the case of certain types of contracts, the government allows, without any notification to subcontractors or suppliers, they allow the bond to be waived, thereby stripping all protection for payment to the subcontractors. And then if the GC or prime decides we're not going to pay you for whatever reason, there is no mechanism of recourse. The only thing you can do is file a lawsuit in order to attempt to be paid.
Which is cheap, as we all know.
Almost no small business is great.
Can I make a suggestion on this? You guys have an amazing organization that's helping these folks be heard, and we have a member of the Office of Advocacy here. This is such a complex area, but it's one that's obviously so important. Maybe you all talk afterwards about teaming up to put together a short paper, not a lot of work, but really articulate all of these issues in something that could then be submitted. It's going to be more powerful that way. And I have a feeling that this has a pretty good likelihood of getting into the report to the president, because we've heard it at other stops. So, but this is the most sort of the fullest discussion I've heard. I think it's important.
This is a very active area in contract.
Yeah,
and
clearly.
And we do a lot at the SBDC to try to help businesses figure out if it's even worth it.
But maybe, you know, if we could put it all together.
Okay. John, I cut you off before.
Yeah, I don't know how I'm going to say this because I have a range of emotions sitting here in my reply. But I think that we've gotten off track here a little bit, and I was kind of disappointed in the way this conversation is headed, because I really want to bring it back to what Brad was talking about at the beginning of here, where the White House's job, in my opinion, is not to come and make the small businesses' life easier. And in many ways, some of the things we've been talking about are because the government butted in when they probably shouldn't have butted in. Mm-hmm. So stay away from the small businesses. They make our lives better. We all love them. We all want more of them. And we all want it to be easier. So butt out. High growth entrepreneurship is going to make this country a leader again in innovation. And that's what we need to be focusing in this conversation, in my opinion, is all these smart minds in the room. You know, if you own a mom-and-pop pizza shop or something like that, you're not going to change this country's, you know, economic outlook. You're going to make great pizza and make a lot of people really happy and make Boulder a great place to live. And I think that's great. And you should be a part of the SBDC so that you can learn how to attract more customers and be a better business and win that government contract and get your feedback heard. But we got to start saying something here about how are we going to help people who are making medicine better, or making technology.
Absolutely. So give us your problem and let's come up with a solution.
The things that are going to keep us, as the United States, a leader in the free
world. That's why we're here. So
come on, guys. We're Boulder. We got this stuff. Stop complaining about. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, come on.
So I'd like to speak to the human capital pipeline.
That's you, yes.
Okay. I want to make sure I was all the way in the back. So the pipeline is, you know, for highly trained technical folks, broken in several places. So I'll start at the top. You know, a graduate degree in science and engineering ought to come with a visa application stapled to it. Going down.
Back it up. What should come?
The degree? So a graduate degree in science or engineering, it should not be very difficult for that person to get a visa to work in the United States, and it is. The second thing is that in order for that person to come to graduate school, he or she has to demonstrate fiscal responsibility greater than it takes to attend graduate school, you know, for several years. And you know, specific example, to come for a master's degree, someone has to show they have $42,000 American, you know, available. The INS requires that to issue a visa. So make it realistic.
Okay. I was privy to some of the things that have been heard in all the different sessions, and that's been on the table. Do you want to talk about?
No, just the idea that's come up before is we have this outflow of human capital after they come to our graduate schools to go back and start high growth operations overseas. Wouldn't it be great if they stayed here for 5 years, for example? And so one is the visa issue. If you're going to work for a startup, for instance, can you get an extension on your student visa for some period of time? You'd have to demonstrate that you're doing certain things that are viewed as value added. And there's another, I think, which is the founding member issue. You can get a visa to come over as a...
Wait, can I, I'm sorry, yeah. Can I stop you?
Yeah, please.
You have to demonstrate that you're showing, that you just said you have to demonstrate that right. You're showing that you're doing certain things. That's part of the problem now.
Right, so
somebody who comes out,
how would you define it?
Somebody comes out, well, they have to, if it, like you just said, a graduate of, in sciences and engineering in the U.S., if they're going to do something, give them a visa.
Anything at all.
Anything. Even, that's
yeah. I'm not sure that that's going to happen, but I think, though, if it's to support new ventures, entrepreneurship, my sense is that getting a somewhat open-ended extension on a student visa simply because you come to this country to go to graduate school, I'm just speaking realistically, is going to be a tough sell. If you can tie it to certain business activities that are highly valuable to the country, where you otherwise are having a flight of human capital, intellectual capital, my sense is you could probably get some bipartisan support around this. I think this is actually a congressional change, not just a regulatory change.
Companies outsource their software development rather than be able to hire.
I'm sorry?
Would you rather people outsource their
software? No, I would rather do something like this, which is why I'm trying to figure out the best way to get it through in a highly politicized area, immigration. But I think, unfortunately. But yes, this is a great idea. We need to think more seriously about how to frame this up.
And I'm just saying, putting parameters on that. A computer scientist, PhD, who's graduating from MIT, whatever they want to do in the United States, let them do it, because guess what? It's going to be productive. And that's the idea. Okay. So doing parameters, they have to do something that causes 5 jobs to be hired, or they have to work for this size company, or
right.
if they're doing something in their garage, we want them to stay here and do that.
Mm-hmm.
Write it on a tablet.
Fair enough. I understand the point exactly.
Okay, are we switching to a new topic?
No.
Let's do a little more on immigration.
Well, it's human capital, right?
Yeah, human capital.
I don't know if this is exactly human capital, but it doesn't feel to me like there's a culture that celebrates success in this country. We vilify rich people. We vilify oil companies. We've got a horribly complex tax code, where our best and brightest are trying to figure out how to get away around taxes instead of using their brain power to grow the economy. One example, it took Mitchell Energy 15 years of investing their own money to figure out how to frack, and now we have more natural gas than we know what to do with. Okay. This is what America does best.
Let me ask you to go the other side of the picture. So you're articulating the barrier. What do you want to see happen?
Instead of having government help us more, let's cut government. Cut government spending 10-20%. Let's get out of the way and let people do what they do best. This country
could you be specific?
Simplify the tax code.
Okay.
Inheritance taxes are outrageous. Again, stop vilifying oil companies. Stop vilifying rich people. Start celebrating success.
Okay.
So can I disagree with you like strongly? Because I've lived in 4 other countries before the U.S., and I have to very, very strongly disagree with you. I mean, I lived in the U.K., Scandinavia, Italy, and Germany, actually 5. I think the U.S. is a country that definitely supports the creation of wealth and looks up to people that create wealth and jobs to everyone. I'm not going to talk about the government, the taxes, things like that, but just the attitude. I don't think that we can say really honestly that the U.S. has an attitude that is not supportive to entrepreneurship and wealth creation. I'd say absolutely the opposite.
I second that.
Okay, so before, you go.
I'm going to ask your permission that we absolutely not talk generalities and not. And we'll lead to politics, and we won't get anywhere. Right.
Yeah. I'm and here because we support entrepreneurship.
So we're, not we don't respect it, and there can be another venue to have that conversation. So
actually, I want to say something else about how to, and I'm surprised that nobody has mentioned this. I think the biggest obstacle to early stage ventures is access to capital.
Right.
And I'm really surprised that nobody has mentioned that. And I think the UK is a country that they've got a lot of things wrong, but this have got right, and they have two ways to access capital or to give good capital access to early stage ventures. One is through tax breaks to investors under the Enterprise Investment Scheme.
Say the last one.
Enterprise Investment Scheme.
I understand in the UK?
UK, yeah.
Okay.
And very, very shortly, what that does is that it creates an incentive for people like me, who are financiers, to invest in early stage ventures. And the second thing is that there are funds, government funds, or funds that are private funds but take government money. So they have a mandate to invest in early stage ventures and create returns. And they also have a mandate to co-invest with private individuals. So a total of $1 million, $500,000 comes from this fund, which is essentially takes some government money, and $500,000 has to come from private individuals. And what that has done, that it has created a network of early stage small funds and entrepreneurs, business angels that want to invest together.
Are these almost matching funds?
Yes, these are
exactly. So government funds are then matched with private funds.
Correct.
Within the same.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So in other words, if the government's putting in a dollar, there's private capital that's putting in some amount
but
more.
But this is not the government that is investing. It are private funds that have a combination of government money and also institutional investors.
Okay.
And they
That's great. I'm going to ask you to be really succinct. And
let me say one very succinct thing, which is just look at the Startup America website. I believe there's $2 billion in funding through this initiative that is going to early stage enterprises. So that's one of the things we try to push out.
That's matched with VC, though, right?
I'm sorry?
That's matched with VC.
I don't know. You'd have to look at the details.
So I think it's matched with VC dollars, which is great.
It's routed through the VCs.
So, which is great, but VCs are actually not early stage.
So it's not early stage enough.
It's not early
stage. Okay, fair enough. Very good point.
So that leads me to my next comment, which is the SBA real loans do not work for early stage.
Okay, we've heard that before.
Because that's bank-based financing.
Okay, that's helpful.
More venture angel-type financing. And so that, for instance, a personal guarantee completely, most high-growth companies will not touch the SBA because nobody's going to give a personal guarantee. And also, which you laugh at.
I'm not laughing.
But it's very, the stronger, the more experienced the entrepreneur is, the less likely that they will do that. Because most companies, they're risking enough. So, but it really has to be, if you're starting, and I just went through a year ago, starting a new company pre-revenue, you don't have anything, and you do have to give you money, realizing, that the chance of it happening is, so it's almost like a grant type system. It is like research. It is like medical research. You give me some money, I'm going to go do some research here, and maybe something will come out of it.
Okay.
Speaking of the SBA, I've been turned down in the last 8 months by 7 banks. And the commonality is all for the same reason, which is we don't look at what you say you're going to do. We kind of look at what you've done so far in the last 3 years. So this year, to give you a specific example, last year we did 1.2 million sales. This year we'll do, depending on how fast we grow, the excess money, we'll do 3 to 4 million in sales. So pretty accelerated growth at a 20% profit margin. The banks say you don't qualify, not even for SBA, because we're going to look at what you did the last 3 years. It's too risky. So what I'm seeing from that is that there seems to be a point that the banks will own up to. And if they're not really comfortable, they'll pop you into SBA. But then beyond that, SBA has no advantage over conventional lending.
Okay. Even if the risk is completely mitigated banks in the current climate, that $45 billion, how do we actually get banks, this changed over the last 5 years?
And what I was told, Kyle-wise, is we're going to look at how we're going to approve this loan, is we're going to look at your ability to pay it back based on what you say is happening right now. Then, if that doesn't work, we're going to look at the ability for you to pay it back if none of this new business happens. Then we're going to look at your ability to pay it back personally if the whole business tanks. If you don't meet all three of those, you don't qualify. And that's the gatekeeper for the SBA.
We get it.
Yeah.
We do. Both comments. One short question I have.
Yeah,
do you find
question.
A little more traction here because of Foundry Group and Brad and Techstars and all of that for early stage startups?
Yeah, so Techstars is the model. The problem is that that's only in internet and technology, so it's very limited.
Yes.
It needs
okay.
to be broader.
That's great.
That's exactly the model.
So essentially, the Startup America partnership, if I understand correctly,
yes.
really was launched out of what the Techstars model to start.
Yes.
And Techstars really is very much focused on software, IT, Internet 2.0.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Techstars, I'll tell you.
But that influence isn't helping us with debt capital.
Hold that thought.
We're trying to come up with solutions to some of the problems.
So one of the solutions would be to expand what Techstars is doing into other sectors. And Kathy is leaving, but I'm sure that you would agree with that on the biotech side. So I think that lots of people would. I mean, am I correct that people would agree that that would be?
Yeah, and that should almost be industry agnostic. So I don't know that it should
right.
be. And I mean, I know that biotech and clean energy are the key things. There's actually an entrepreneurial around natural products here in Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
So I work for Horizon Organic. So
those
are all
scalable companies.
Scalable companies, you know, grocery chains,
right.
I mean, anything can happen out of that. So
okay.
we should don't miss me.
I think that's pretty tangible. Wait.
Can I talk about the solution for this?
Yes.
That I think right now, the SBA said to the banks, you know, we'll guarantee these loans. I think the SBA needs to go a little farther and say, this is how we want to use the money. These are the parameters that we're going to allow you to do the loan. So the bank has, okay, a conventional loan looks like this, an SBA loan looks like this. Not a conventional loan looks like this, an SBA loan looks like that.
We have very successful, competent NGOs on the SBA side. The complaint isn't with the SBA.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I had a bank, before they would agree to partner to do an SBA package, asked me for a letter of credit equal to the entire amount of the loan, saying, if you have the cash for this acquisition, then we'll lend you the money and charge you for it, with the SBA involved.
So I think, in a nutshell, the SBA is there to do the guarantee to mitigate the loan, but the banks won't let it move forward.
They're not being tasked with actually assisting this with mitigating risk.
I don't think a solution's been found yet.
Do banks want to participate?
We're talking about two different problems here. Because
yeah.
the SBA does not apply to early stage ventures.
Right,
it
we got
not,
that.
Actually,
it can.
Actually, it can.
No, if you don't have any revenue.
No, 10 years ago, I got an SBA loan.
Okay.
If there was twice the company's revenue.
And you had the personal
Okay, hang on. I promised to call on you. I'm so sorry.
Her hands were full.
Different topic. Specific to your department, regulatory review.
Yeah.
Three suggestions when you're looking at stopping regulation. Number one would be pacing.
I'm sorry?
Pacing. So rapid increased regulation over one sector. You need to find a reasonable time frame for implementation for, in particular, small companies, startups, entrepreneurs. So pacing the time frame which you let regulation impact a specific industry. When you have have, the second would be overlapping regulations. So for instance, the Federal Reserve and HUD regulation overlapping on TILA and RESPA, if you need a specific reference. Overlapping regulations, which is impacting the same process or same business, that needs significant review.
Okay, the third.
And then the third is just when you have those, you were talking about today, how would you look back and evaluate regulation? Mm-hmm. One suggestion I would have is after you've had a major pendulum swing, such as the financial crisis, you have immediately after something like that rapid regulation trying to prevent those problems from happening mm-hmm. again. So looking back in time, at times of rapid regulation, yes. and really yes. assessing when we go into a extreme oversight, what unintended consequences do we have?
Okay, thank you. That's great. Let's go back to, let's take John's comment, let's take Brad's comment. We're talking about emerging industries, high growth companies. Sir?
Apple can save the federal government tens of millions of dollars if they would just use my software. Dozens of people in the Fed would love to be able to use at GSA. It's that simple. You can't use it because there's some national use of a piece of software that's already obsolete, causes all sorts of frustration amongst the people, and is incredibly costly. In the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars. They just issued a task order for $20 million just for training. Now, I've been in...
On the old system?
On the old system. So I've talked to many of the directors here in the region.
These are GSA? Or
Region 8.
Of GSA?
Yes. And, in fact, even the Obama appointee has stated, this is fabulous, but I haven't been able to get it there. Dan has seen my software. It's all about...
And this would save, just because I'm thinking about what I can do with this is going to save the government money? Is it going to save private sector folks money?
It also, because the government's paying it. Let me just give you an example. A week and a half ago, I visited with the director of special projects. He's from central office. He's in charge of all the construction for the ports and all the border stations. They've got about a $200 million budget. He stated that in order to implement the software, EPM, he went out and asked one firm that they have a project with, what would it cost to train the people, the sub-consultants? They came back with $500,000 just for one firm as additional cost to the federal government to do this. The guy that was doing training in Region 8 quit recently because he's frustrated.
Okay.
A lot of people aren't even using this.
So let's talk afterwards a little more. That's fine.
Let me try this a different way. For those of you that are really high growth entrepreneurs, do you have any issues with the patent process?
Evil.
Sorry.
It's evil. Evil.
Go ahead.
Doesn't belong to software companies.
Doesn't belong to software companies. Couldn't support that one. And I'm a lawyer.
It's just a threat that someday some troll will come sue us and take away all the jobs that we've created.
Okay. Say it again.
Yeah, no, it just gets in the way. I mean, software patents, you know, Brad has talked long and hard about this as well, is that software patents basically just get in the way.
Yeah.
And the reality is that you come up with an idea, you want to pursue it, you put money into it,
right.
And then sure enough, somebody will knock on your door, or venture capitalists or somebody will come in and do the due diligence and say, you can't do that. That idea is gone. And it really, really stifles, let alone the $10,000-$15,000 that it costs in time and investment. It's really that stifling impact on ideas.
So,
widgets, products,
yep.
washing machines.
So, in the software industry, you actually would get rid of patents. In other words, things are going too fast.
It's not a U.S. problem. Even if you abolish it in the U.S., but everybody else is patenting the ideas, you still
Well, you may not be able to move that into a foreign environment. But why can't you file if you think you're going to go there? You can still file in a foreign patent application. You can file in the individual jurisdiction. So nothing restricts your ability to patent in foreign jurisdictions. It's just whether
it could improve U.S. competitiveness if we had fewer barriers to software innovation here, even if they were restricted overseas. I don't know.
I would put something
by foreign patents.
Number one,
This is not this comes up a lot, and it comes up specifically in the software area. We've heard this before.
Yeah.
But that's a real challenge because where does software stop and hardware begin? Right. The washing machine with a piece of software in it, and it has a functionality that's enabled by that software. Did you patent the software, or what did you just patent there? Right, and so it's very difficult to draw that line of no software patents when software is in everything, right? So.
I would challenge that. I would think that if it's a tangible item, then sure, patent the design of the washing machine. But the software,
there are processes. There's process.
Yeah, we're not talking about washing machine.
Okay. It's an important issue that we actually have the deputy PTO commissioner who does a lot of these, and I think patent issues are very much on her radar screen for this. Yeah.
It's a new comment.
It is.
Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about access to capital and sort of SBA early, mid, late stage capital. We didn't talk about sort of mid and late stage. TechStars Group doing a great job for early. Mid-stage is a problem right now, but I'm more interested in late-stage. We have 250 employees. We hire one every 3-4 days, and we're on the verge of maybe a year away from going public. The difficulties in taking the company public in this environment, the SOX and the SAC, make it so that 9 out of 10 companies that could, in fact, be vibrant, standalone, growing companies that are anchors for communities, it's so expensive to go public and it's so difficult and expensive to stay public that these companies all get sold off. If we could reform SOX to make it easier for companies to get out and to get access to public market capital, we'd see a lot more very innovative, high-growth companies last for a while rather than get acquired by big companies that tend to destroy the technologies and the companies themselves.
Do you need something more specific?
I'm not sure what the reform. Would you have an idea what the reform would be?
There's been some talk, at least a while ago, about SOX of having two different categories of companies: ones that are, super large and emerging high growth companies. It's silly to think that we would have to spend all of our profits on being public for the first 2 years of being a public company, rather than plow that back into more product development and more employees.
So literally, what are you suggesting? For the first 2 years, what happens?
Small emerging companies and becoming eligible to have access to public capital, being a public company.
Okay.
So, I think you're getting at something here. So 2 years of deferred cost, deferred regulation.
SOX.
Repealing SOX for small companies.
Yeah, well, defer the cost, right? You've got to have the infrastructure. So,
bankers, $10 million, several $1 million a year.
Why do you want to be public? Why can't you be private? Just thriving private company.
Because high growth companies spend capital efficiently
and grow their business. And our capital markets are one of the best things we've got going for us in this country.
But why? It's very expensive to be a public company if you don't have a certain revenue size. And there's a lot of very successful small or 100, 200 million mid-cap private companies. Why do you need to be private?
Public or sell your business within 10 years as a VC-backed business, which has the fund dynamics of how the VCs invest.
Mm-hmm. You have to sell it. You don't have to become public.
Yeah, but we can shut it somebody down and sell it to somebody or we can go public. It's a real common model within venture-backed companies.
Okay, hold that.
Maybe I was going to compromise, and I'm not extremely read up on this, but someone can probably put me in. There's a lot of secondary markets going on right now for really sophisticated investors. Maybe the SEC makes that easier. So if you have VCs that can exit after 3 years in a secondary market, they can probably go elsewhere. maybe that's kind of a compromise between going public but still having liquidity to actually get your money out there. Maybe if the SEC makes that secondary market a lot easier, maybe that's something to help.
Okay. So what's that, how do we say that in plain English?
I've always known the secondary markets. It's kind of where sophisticated investors can go online and trade in shares. Like Facebook right now, you can, if you're at certain levels, you can buy shares of Facebook. But you have to have certain qualifications that go along
with it. Would it be...
don't stifle secondary private markets.
Right. So basically SEC regulation needs to allow for robust secondary markets, right?
Leave it alone as it is right now.
Right. If you have a couple $1 million worth of private capital and you're investing in that, you're sophisticated enough to take chances on a non-disclosed company.
Brad's words don't fuck up.
Okay, so there's the don't screw it up, but, to me, not Brad. But then is there a way to actually nurture it? Is there a reason to nurture it?
Or does the market nurture it?
Yeah. I mean, it's literally if the SEC gets out of
there. But the idea is, because obviously there's concern about protecting investors. Your point is, in the secondary market, you have sophisticated investors.
Right.
It's basically investor emptor, or caveat emptor for the investors. And that's these are the most sophisticated investors out there.
Okay.
Interesting.
So, I think it has to be that way. I mean, I don't think that the SEC is really intruding with the secondary market at all at this point. But you need to be able to protect the ones that are not so sophisticated investors or approved investors or high net worth individuals, the mom and pop, that don't understand that these kind of securities have a lower liquidity, higher degree of risk, and things like that. So,
but those people aren't the ones investing in small companies. Those aren't the people we're trying to talk about right now. My dad's in the stock market with a little bit of money, but he's looking at Marathon Oil, that kind of thing. He's not looking at the other companies, so I don't know if that's a problem necessarily here.
No, but as it is, I think it's fine. I mean, there's no...
Yeah, it doesn't sound like, though, at this point yet, there is a problem with overregulation, right?
Sure there is.
No,
there is. Of secondary markets?
Actually, even on the earlier stage, so, if you go out and raise $100,000, from potential investors, the comment that I would get over and over again is, call me when you need $1 million or $2 million, because it's the same amount of paperwork as to invest $10,000 in a private company that you think is probably going to fail and it is to invest $2 million.
Okay, and are those SEC forms?
Those are SEC.
Okay, so now we're on to something here. So basically, reducing the paperwork burden of SEC paperwork burden for investments in smaller companies, micro companies, early stage.
$1 million or $500,000 have maybe like a 1040 EZ version of this is all you need to write. I'm going to invest this much money in the company. I'm going to get this percentage of the company or this amount of shares, and it should be quick and easy. The other regulation that could change is that legally with the SEC, I cannot ask a friend of mine to make an introduction to a potential investor and to say, hey, Jason's a great guy, you should invest with him, because then they are a broker. And I can also not advertise, so legally, I can't go on Craigslist. I mean, there's some things about going on Craigslist and saying, hey, I'm trying to fund a company. So there's that whole broker arrangement, but also advertising that you are promoting that you are looking for funds.
What do we do about it?
So the solution would be to allow introductions, allow the broker agent agreements, changing that within private placements. Mm-hmm. So if do you understand that?
I do understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it goes back to the same idea of the original regulation was meant to protect.
Is meant to protect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how do we do this without taking away the protection?
But to his earlier point, that these investors are more sophisticated generally, mm-hmm. and they're also smaller dollar amounts. So that protection, you're protecting you're providing all of this protection for a group of investors that frankly shouldn't need it or don't really need it.
Okay, so forgive my ignorance in this piece.
Yes.
Is there a process for becoming an approved investor, net worth, you know, whatever?
Yes, there is. You have to be. Yes, and you do have to, and that's fine. So right now you have to be to invest in an angel investment. You have to be a high net worth individual, so you have to have family income of $200,000 a year, and you have to or be worth over, I believe, $1 million, and you do need to prove that. That's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that those people, to somebody, you know, Bill Gates can say, sure, I'll invest $10,000 in your company, and there'll be as much paperwork as there will be when he invests in.
Okay, so we had streamlining the paperwork, and then
yes.
You also said allowing introductions.
Allowing the introductions, a broker agent agreement.
Okay, thank you. Very specific. Anything else on capital before we move on? Yes. No, sorry.
It kind of fits in what you're saying. To me, from the people that I work with that I know that have a big impact, is knocking down the barriers between passive income and active income, because you have so much losses that have been created over the last few years that just sit there because you can't apply them to anything unless you have passive income. I just know from the people that I work with that if they could have access to that and feel like they recovered quicker, they're investors, that's what they do. They would put that money back to work.
That's a change.
Because right now, if you have $1 million in losses, what stock market, you get $3,000.
You lose it fast, but you can't get it back very fast.
To recover passive losses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Capital? Yes.
So we talked about the SBA approval, we talked about, and then come back to Brad's comment earlier around. You know, so there's a couple kinds of innovation. There's sort of the small businesses, and then there's these entrepreneurial sort of businesses. So I guess I'd love to understand, we talked about this, billions of dollars of funding that's available through the SBA. Is it intended for these entrepreneurial growth companies? And if it is, what would be the guidelines for one of those companies to actually get the money? Because it's completely unclear to me. I mean, I can maybe divide it from the different conversations you had, that the money will flow into maybe venture funds, and coupled with other private money, and then the venture guys invest it. You know, maybe that's the way the money gets there. But I guess I have a couple of specific questions. May not answer here. It would be helpful to know is any of that money supposed to go to these entrepreneurial high growth companies or not?
I think the answer is yes.
And if so, what's the access method for that?
I have no idea. But this is not my piece of this. But there are people here who know, and we should grab them after the next session. You should talk to Alan Kim and some of the other folks from SBA who are here, and they can tell you or direct you to the website where you can find out. Okay.
Yeah. So part of the answer really is that they are different programs. There are many different programs, so some may be suitable and some not.
There's a barrier. There's a communication barrier.
Yeah, I understand. That's why we're here. Yeah, and they are trying to push it out. But yes, people don't know about it. And yeah, no, I gotcha. It's the challenge of government is to get people to know all of the different things that are going on all the time, and I hear you.
Okay, capital, and let's move on.
Yeah. So, you know, with that, I really do think there also needs to be an exact definition of really what it means to be a high-growth startup versus the small business, because that's not anywhere on the website. It's still kind of out there right now, and how the government and SBDC can ensure that these early stages are being funded. So sort of, okay, you have to give it to these type of businesses, and this is the criteria that it takes.
So the difference, the definition
of a high growth, startup versus a small business and how to get that funding.
Okay.
Okay.
I can answer that, but that's not what we're here for.
But maybe that's kind of what we're here for.
Yeah, why don't we? Do you want to tell them?
Let's stay late.
Right.
No, seriously.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to bring it back to high growth, but that's the focus today. So, in the back.
A quick potentially hairball idea related to early stage
that's
capital.
Cool.
So, would the SBA be willing to increase its role as a guarantor for a piece of the downstream potential upside?
Peter with the car companies.
Could create a holding company. You know, the upside could go to a holding company, then you could reinvest in other companies.
They do that when they invest alongside into a VC fund.
Yeah. But not in early.
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
And they've had Vista Ventures and Appian Ventures here in town both had SBIR matching funds.
So do we want to give a thumbs up for the SBA to take a role in
the equivalent
of venture capital, some kind of investment fund, and take a piece of it rather than taking a part of the interest rate? Is that what you're saying?
Okay.
Interesting. And there are some tools out there that are now, I think, actually growing. So there may be an answer to that as well.
Just always remember that, especially at this time, the problem right now is not the amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
There is both on the venture capital side or in the banks, right? It's greasing the skids so that money is going into businesses.
Right.
So that's just an important,
understand.
Important point. Yeah. So matching funds, that's great, but I can tell you, if you're getting venture capital funding, you don't necessarily need, you know, it's nice to get a little extra, but that's not the issue.
No, but if we go, and I think it was you who said that the venture fund actually gets managed by venture capitalists, but SBA is putting money in to create a bigger pool. So that, I think, is part of the solution. One more on capital? Okay. All the way in the back.
Yeah, I would say another access, easy thing that you can implement in the next short time period is that the phase 3 part of the SBA right now really doesn't have any teeth to it. 5% of the now $2 billion of SBIR funding, you're talking about $100 million public venture capital that could be managed by existing infrastructure in the SBIR program. So that's an alternative to the SBA public venture capital as well. It could be for smaller amounts that cover this valley of death.
Okay. Yes, please. So,
what would you say?
Third phase SBIR funding.
Mm-hmm.
Put teeth to it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
SBIR funding.
And there was something that you mentioned during the panel about SBIR not really helping you go to market.
That in phase 3, if it was dedicated to commercialization, so developing, manufacturing, marketing, and sales. Right now, you can't use SBIR funding for that, but if you could have access phase 3 for
new topic. New topic around emerging scalable businesses.
Thank you. I'm not sure this is a federal level, but in my side of the emerging high growth markets, one of the biggest generators of ideas for universities and one of the hardest groups in the world to deal with are tech transfer offices. In big public institutions, I don't know, it's like they are trained in the entrepreneurial world. There's something big missing that takes ideas out of universities and turns them into commercial companies.
So one of this has come up before, and one of the ideas was if research universities were getting federal money to do research which is leading to IP, that there, and maybe there already are things, but people seem to think there weren't enough sort of requirements on what is then done with that IP, that IP should have to be either commercialized within a certain amount of time or dedicated to the public, or should be licensed within a certain amount of time at reasonable rates so you can recover costs and a fair profit, but you get it out because there was a sense among some that these universities, with the help of federal funds, are now sitting on large stocks of IP, and it's really not available to the community to use. And these are nonprofit institutions that, through federal funding. Okay.
So folks are going to be coming in any second. If you could just raise your hand if you've dealt with a tech transfer office. And if you're experiencing the same, put your hand down. Okay. And is there anyone who's dealt with more than one? Okay. So in other words, this is not just a unique university. This has to do with tech transfer in general.
It's more specific to public universities.
Yeah, we heard this in Research Triangle a lot in North Carolina. So, yeah.
We've seen research.
There are some good examples.
Great.
Okay, I really want to thank everyone for participating and putting up with the fragmented conversation. But.